Severe weather warning is expected to continue until the experiments are concluded.
This is the Blackwater Ethercast.
I wouldn't describe my efforts over the last few days as entirely unsuccessful, but neither was it my most glorious moment ever. One does what one must. The hastily convened voyage from Dundee to Calais was, by all appearances, swift and uneventful. Though he was given little to do, Mr. Reed performed capably and verified my decision to move him toward the position of steward. McThomas quietly assisted with the small projects I had brought to pass the time. For my part, the projects were merely to keep my hands busy while my mind raced ahead to the coming conflict. Pondering the possibilities, I had the odd feeling that I was writing a script, but one for which the order of events was unknown to the playwright, and in which neither the hero nor the villain might be apparent to the audience. The very actors being largely unaware of their roles, they had the feel and predictability of forces of nature rather than groups of individuals. Perhaps that is the way humans actually are and behave. The more of them there are, the more predictable they can be. I have certainly found it so, and found the knowledge practical on occasion. But while the actions of a herd may be predicted, it is not always an easy task to turn the buffalo to a useful direction without being trampled. Thus ran my thoughts as my hands performed the more calm and predictable dances with cams and scape wheels. As quickly as a Royal Mail ship travels, it still seemed a small eternity until we arrived in the port of Calais. Naturally, my primary concern was to land well ahead of the Intrepid League. I had little notion of how quickly they would be able to board the inventively named SS Intrepid, nor from which port it would leave. The few things we had brought would nonetheless take a certain amount of time to be unloaded. I wanted to be gone from sight before the League had a chance to dock. Unfortunately, the Intrepid was seen steaming over the horizon before we had reached our berth. Minutes crept by with excruciating slowness as the process of docking was completed. McThomas hastily arranged for our equipment and luggage to be the first to disembark. Reed prepared a message boy for immediate dispatch so that my local contacts would be able to take care of our things. Then it was a matter of waiting. I hate waiting. When the gangway was finally in place, I checked to see the position of the Intrepid. It was quite close. They would take far less time to dock than we had, and at this point, they would certainly know that we had arrived. I located a porter and gave him some money. "What is your name, young man?" "Berkeley." "Well, Mr. Berkeley, I have a small but lucrative task for you. That rather heroic-looking ship over there, the one approaching the docks at a nearly dangerous speed, carries people who will be looking for me. I need you to wait by the gangway. They will approach you and ask where I have gone." "Yes, I am Lord Blackwater." "No, you are in no particular danger. Where do people get these odd ideas?" "Here is what I need you to do. Wait by the gangway. They will ask if you have seen me. Do not tell them that you have been waiting for them, but say that yes, you have seen me. They will ask where I have gone." "I am not going to tell you where I am going, and you would not believe me if I told you. So you will truthfully tell them that you do not know. However, just before telling them, I need you to glance briefly at that clock tower to the west. That is all. Just look for an instant at the clock tower and tell them that you don't know where I went. Can you do that?" "Excellent. An employee of mine will be watching, and if you do as I've instructed, he will triple the amount which I have just given you." "Thank you, Mr. Berkeley. It has been a pleasure doing business with you." Young Mr. Berkeley tipped his hat, and we turned to leave. Reed retrieved the money he would need from McThomas and went to find a place from which to observe. The rest of us followed the road west briefly, then circled the block to the south, and proceeded with all speed to the east, where the cartel's compound awaited. In today's entertainment, Shakespeare describes the roles of a man. All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players. They have their exits and their entrances, and one man in his time plays many parts, his acts being seven ages. At first the infant, mewling and puking in the nurse's arms, then the whining schoolboy with his satchel and shining morning face, creeping like a snail unwillingly to school. And then the lover, sighing like a furnace, with a woeful ballad made to his mistress's eyebrow. Then a soldier, full of strange oaths and bearded like the pard, jealous in honor, sudden and quick in quarrel, seeking the bubble reputation even in the cannon's mouth. And then the justice, in fair round belly with good capon lined, with eyes severe and beard of formal cut, full of wise saws and modern instances, and so he plays his part. The sixth age shifts into the lean and slippered pantaloon, with spectacles on nose and pouch on side, his youthful hose well saved, a world too wide for his shrunk shank, and his big manly voice turning again toward childish treble, pipes and whistles in his sound. Last scene of all, that ends this strange, eventful history, is second childishness and mere oblivion, sans teeth, sans eyes, sans taste, sans everything. The guards at the compound seemed neither more nor less alert than usual. We proceeded to the headquarters, noting only normal activity among the buildings. They had no idea that they were in danger. DuPont happened to be in the courtyard and raised his eyebrows when my party arrived.
"Whatever is the matter, Baron?"
"You are in grave danger. The Intrepid League has caught wind of the weapon I created for you, and are on their way to remove it from your possession, and likely to do what damage they can to your business. As if that were not enough, one of your rival organizations is likely to attack soon as well, with an eye to taking over the entire enterprise. You must arm your new weapon and alert your guards."
"But the new weapon is not even assembled."
"What? This is absurd. Come, we must prepare it at once." René Blanc was alarmed enough at the news that his expression noticeably changed. He barked a series of orders in a tone which made even French sound harsh, and his entire staff began running to fulfill them. I brought my little company and DuPont onto the rooftop patio and immediately got to work assembling the weapon. Fortunately, it had been partly assembled, but I knew we would be hard-pressed to get it in fully working order before any unfriendly forces arrived. Working with new technologies is always a series of tiny, unexpected delays. We had time for very few if the weapon was to do its job. As I worked, I briefly looked over the compound. A ship was at their dock already, so the mob's assault wouldn't come from that direction. I already knew that though delayed, the League would attack from the west, probably focusing on the same entrance that I had used. It was less visible from this position, but frankly, I was less worried about the ability to target the League than the rivals. At last, the swivel mount was secure, and the power coupling working without hindrance. A high-pitched warble marked the internal power baffle's activity, climbing past human hearing as they filled. I began to explain its correct usage to Blanc and the gunner who had wielded the weapon, but DuPont called us from the edge of the patio, pointing to the eastern wall.
"They come!"
Indeed, they did. With a crash and a small explosion, a section of the wall crumbled, replaced by armed mobsters who poured into the compound and spread through the alleys with obvious foreknowledge and planning. As the commotion rose from the cartel's forces' response, another series of shouts began on the west side, exactly where I had predicted they would. The cause was not yet visible, but clearly it was the Intrepid League making their grand entrance. I aimed the weapon at a stack of crates near the breach in the eastern wall and pulled the trigger. A pale blue gleam instantly lanced from the end of the weapon to the center crate, short jets of lightning dancing around it and reaching out to touch a building where it narrowly passed. The crate exploded in a wave of force and splinters, knocking aside anyone within 3 or 4 yards of it. My French clients were clearly impressed by the ad hoc demonstration. The target was, in fact, selected to impress. The truth is, the energy weapon is far less effective the more water a target contains. A wooden box gives a far more dramatic and wide-reaching result as a target than would a living creature, though it will still do the job. It would do little more than warm a puddle of water. I left the gunner to discover the finer points of the weapon, sternly reminding him only of the importance of a proper recharge before handing it over to him. I ran with my men back into the building, calling back to Blanc that I would take care of the League myself. Reaching the ground, we hurried down the hill to where the League did battle with the cartel's guards. The guards were entirely outmatched by the heroes, and gratefully yielded the defensive side to my bodyguards when I told them they were needed in the center and east side of the compound. In only a few moments, Mr. Blair, arms still in a sling, saw me from where he directed his forces. "There's Blackwater now! Seize the villain!" We fought a defensive battle, I with my walking stick and my bodyguards with their various weapons, slowly retreating into the compound and toward the rest of the battling forces. We eventually reached the base of the hill, just above the barracks which sat between us and the dock. I knocked senseless the League's lackey who had been trying to attack me with a truncheon, and Miss Price stepped over him, saber in hand. "Lord Blackwater, this time you have gone too far." "Have I now?" I responded, deflecting her attacks. "Let me guess. I have broken the rules of polite society, and perhaps even actual laws, and you are here to put a stop to it. I am fairly certain I went over all this with Mr. Blair a few days ago. I do what I will, and the wise do not attempt to interfere."
"Such arrogance! You know that you are outnumbered, and even your nefarious clientele cannot aid you, since they are busy fending off an entirely different set of vile criminals. Thus does evil always set its own fall in motion."
"I don't know where you got that idea, but history tells a rather different story. In any case, this is hardly the place for a philosophical discussion. Unless I am very much mistaken, and that is never the way to bet, the invading vile criminals are right now in the process of setting up their own weapon on the taller building just over there. We are about to be near the epicenter of an artillery battle between matched energy weapons. Those explosions you hear are going to be an awful lot closer, and will very likely destroy a fair bit of the area in which we stand." She paused a moment.
"Matched? You built weapons for both sides of this war? I've heard the phrase, no honor among thieves, but this brings it to an entirely new level."
"Yes, yes, I know I'm a villain, but you should perhaps be more concerned with the innocent. This area will soon be blown to matchsticks."
"There are no innocents in this foul lair."
With a series of quick beats, she drove me back and held me against a wall, our weapons crossed between us.
"And now I have bested you, least innocent of all."
"Miss Price, there are children here." She visibly paled under the sweat and dust and glanced back at the windows of the barracks. There were faces.
"My God."
She looked back at me for a moment, and then she was running toward the lower buildings and the dock, shouting for the rest to follow. The others quickly understood her urgency and ran after her. Mr. Blair paused a moment to look curiously at myself and my suddenly opponent-free entourage before following. I saluted him with my fossil-capped walking stick. He gave me a sour look and hurried after his fellows. We regrouped, and after seeing that no one was badly injured, we moved south again to the cartel's headquarter building. The battle was not yet nearby, and we were too close to see the weapon on the upper patio. But every 15 or 20 seconds, a blue beam would slice through the air above us, followed by the sound of an explosion somewhere else in the compound. Mr. Blanc appeared at the side of the patio above us, angrily pointing toward the center of the compound.
"Baron, what is the meaning of this?"
From the building's front courtyard, we could clearly see the building I had mentioned to Price a few minutes before. The mob had indeed set up their energy weapon, and would begin using it at any moment. Behind them, I could see the League emptying the barracks and herding several dozen children toward the dock. I glanced up to see Blanc shake his fist and then point ominously at me. I didn't know which sight angered him more, and I didn't want to be there when he reached the courtyard to find out. For several reasons, it was time to make our exit. We hastily loaded ourselves onto the inside and outside of a coach, and McThomas took the reins. The nervous horses needed very little encouragement to move with all speed down the hill. No sooner had we left the hilltop than the mob's weapon began answering that of the cartel. Explosions and shouts came seemingly from all directions, and the horses were barely controllable. As we approached the gate, a strange hum began to fill the air, one loud note steadily growing in intensity. By the time we thundered past the unconscious guards, it had grown to an unbearable level, drowning out every other sound. The shouts, the battle, the horses' frantic hooves. We had left the compound behind by only a few seconds, when a buzz suddenly entered the note, and a moment later the sound was replaced by a tremendous explosion. Shards of wood flew past us, then a cloud of dust. It became hard to see, so McThomas, with difficulty, drew the horses to a halt. When it cleared enough, I took a pair of guards back to see what had happened. Even from the entrance, we could tell that the headquarters was demolished, as was the building the mob had used for their weapon. Nearby buildings were also flattened or badly damaged. It was hard to tell whether my ears were recovering from the noise, or that the battle had only just rejoined, but shouts were beginning to be audible from the other end of the compound, quickly sweeping southward. We clambered to the top of a partly collapsed wall and verified what we had suspected. The Intrepid League was attacking the remainders of both the cartel and the mob. A group of the heroes spotted us, shouted, and moved our direction. Blair was among them and yelled out, "Halt, you! Your nefarious scheme is at an end!" My guards pushed over a section of wall, halting their advance. "Mr. Blair, you should know by now that I cannot be stopped, and that you should stop trying." "Funny, Baron. I believe that your plans more or less just stopped on their own. Some sort of feedback between your devices caused them to destroy themselves, along with most of your corrupt clients. We have won the day and brought down not one but two repulsive organizations, as well as ending the threat caused by your insane weaponry. And it was made all the easier by your greed. You may have gotten away with it if you had not sold the same weapon to two different bands of criminals. We have stopped you this day." I posed grandly between my bodyguards. "I leave now, but I shall return." When I do return to Calais, whenever that might be, I will likely not inform the Intrepid League of my itinerary. It will probably be some time before I do in any case. It is not a usual destination for me, and quite apart from questions from the authorities, which I do not wish to answer, my more immediate plans include travel the opposite direction, to America. You know, Mr. Blair was quite correct in his assessment. I occasionally forget that he does possess some scientific knowledge. The settings for the spectral recompositors, which lie at the heart of the weapon's ability to cohesively direct energy, were similar enough that they had resonated when activated in each other's presence. The resonance, boosted by the continued energy input from the weapons, amplified itself until it shattered its containers. The twin explosions were the result. Ah well, resonance is often a useful thing, as you know. But it can be tricky.
The Blackwater Ethercast is written, produced, and performed by Nicholas Jovian. Additional voices by Anita Ziesman. Beginning and ending music is by Derek and Brandon Fichter. They can be found at dbfichter.bandcamp.com. Today's entertainment was from As You Like It by William Shakespeare. Be sure to subscribe to the Ethercast and send your friends to lordblackwater.com so they can too. A new chapter is released twice monthly. Also visit lordblackwater.com to be featured entertainment. And thanks for listening, even those of you from the League.